Yeah.
There is no generic word for rice among Indonesians.
And I understand that in Hawaii there's no word for weather in the Hawaiian language.
Why not? Because it never changes?
The same, yeah. I never have to talk about it. That's funny. Yeah, Bob was all right. I got him. We were talking about, and this is an interesting part of it, that folklorists, that you people start to see your subjects in a lot of cases as family, that the ties become a lot stronger than anyone might think you would have in just a strict professional relationship. And it carries over to the staff too. He was talking about all the different kinds of work, how hard it is to describe his job because he has to do so many different things, and all of you do that. And I wanted to ask you if you ended up picking watermelons that day. Last time I was over here, you were about to go pick watermelons.
Yes, that's one of the things that everybody seems to have to do some of, everything from picking watermelons to, the thing I most wanted for my birthday and got it was a jackknife, a Swiss Army knife, because it's so useful in this job, and yet the title state folklife historian doesn't say anything to you about needing a Swiss Army knife. But it's real... It's a very diversified kind of work, to say the least.
He said that when you go out and do shows, you might as well be on a carnival in some ways, because that's the kind of, you're setting up tents. And I remembered when we were talking to, I guess it was Bunny Bartok in Tarpon Springs or Sarasota, that you would be members, you could be honorary members of the Show Folks Club because you do traveling entertainments, and you're in show business in some ways.
It's not just that we do, well, in that particular case, it wasn't just that we do traveling entertainments, but that we do open-air entertainments, because we put on a festival up here. So, yeah, we can be, among the many other hats we wear, we can be honorary members of the Show Folks
Club. Well, I always wondered about you in particular, because your background seems the most academic and the most cloistered. I may be wrong here, but your training is, I think, the most... academic, I would say, and you seem the most intellectual of the bunch, and to be out picking watermelons and rigging tents, it's just a wonderful thing for me to think about it. Did you ever think you'd get into something like this?
I never thought I'd be picking watermelons as part of a job, and also I've been the kind of person that never really had a great exposure to the out-of-doors before I came down to Florida. I grew up in New Haven, Connecticut. Actually, if you know Connecticut, it was Hamden, Connecticut, which is out from New Haven some. And my dad teaches, he's a professor of linguistics at Yale University. So I grew up in the Ivy League university scene, and then went to the University of Pennsylvania, and then went to Harvard for a master's degree, University of Illinois for a doctoral degree. And so I never had lived in anywhere that was smaller than 100,000 people, and nowhere where I really had to do much with the outside, with nature. That's right. And so, yeah, I guess I've had a kind of academic upbringing from the word go. My mom was a teacher also. I guess that's what I really enjoyed most about this job, is coming into a situation where I can do academically related things, but also work with the public and work with very diverse kinds of situation, so that one minute you're working on something, on a project that is where you're trying to define a certain aspect of culture, and then a half hour later you're on the phone with somebody trying to settle a problem with producing a record, talking with some firm or studio or recording agency, and then a half hour after that you might be out putting up a tent and trying to drive stakes into the ground and trying to figure out why the tent is falling apart because it's just been rained on and what to do about it. And it's there's a lot of variety.
And working with prisoners, for instance. Bob mentioned that the other day, the work group, that sometimes you begin to see yourself as a warden or an overseer or something.
He's had to do a lot of that. you know, sort of being an overseer for the prison crews that we have, one of the things that, like any state agency, we have access to local inmates to help us do some of the kinds of things we need to do, like moving chairs and heavy physical labor. And that's a good way for us to cut our costs by having, you know, people like that who are willing to, or who are volunteered to help us.
So your work is so, well, it's amazing that you have so much going on at one time. How do you do all that? How does that work?
Well, sometimes you do, well, you're always doing more than you think you can possibly do. And sometimes you don't do it as well as you'd like to do. I've been thinking about that recently and realizing that in the academic world, you're always being encouraged to take your time and go for 95% accuracy or whatever. In this kind of job, you almost have to be the kind of person who will make your decisions more quickly, do things more quickly, and settle for 80% accuracy. And the hard part of the part that you have to really work out in your own mind is what that 80% is. In other words, what part you can leave out without feeling that you've really done your subject an injustice.
How much of your work is interpretive? A lot of it is just gathering raw material. You're out in the field. We've talked about field work, and I've talked to some of the other people. And that is not so much interpretive, although you're doing that all the time. But there must be a time, and I'm wondering what percentage of your time, do you just sit down and try to sift it all out and look at it and decide what you've actually got and what it means?
The way our work is structured in this program, a lot less of your time is really interpretive than you'd like. A lot more of it, the sheer physical effort and time involved in gathering information is far outweighs the amount of time you ever have to sift through it. And that's one of the things that all of us talk about, you know, from time to time, is that our most long-term contribution, you know, to the state or to our own organization will have been in the collecting of information so that other people who, in the future, who have more time can sift through certain aspects of it and really, you know, come up with some good analyses of things or approaches to the material. The kind of interpretation we do is a more immediate kind, very pragmatic, usually related to particular project that we're doing. So, for example, I'm working with the production of a record, and it involved with that production is the putting together of a little booklet, explanatory booklet with notes and biographical essays about the subjects. And this is the record about Ida Goodson from Pensacola and her music. And most of the time I put in on it was in the field, either interviewing her or recording her in set recording sessions. And the amount of time that I'm really going to be able to devote to writing that booklet, it may be as much as 2 weeks full time, spread over 3 months. And that all you can do, you see, is put your very best effort into that and rely on your past training to and just to know that what you do in 2 weeks might be a lot better than what the next four people could do in those same 2 weeks because you have the training to back it up.
And you witness it firsthand.
Right, and you've been there in the field, you've talked to the person, you have a personal, friendly rapport with that, you know, with the subject of the record, so it isn't like you're coming into it cold. But actually making sense out of the information and putting it together and making something constructive with it is, that's really in some ways it's the hardest part, and in some ways it's also the most fun for me as an academic kind of person. But in many ways, too, it's very frustrating because you can't spend the time that you'd like to with it.
Is it a common course that a folklorist during a career will spend the early part of his or her life when you theoretically have a lot of energy, and then you're out in the field, and then later you begin to lay back more and sit in the chair and make the connections that you've been gathering material for the most part? Is that... Or that's not necessarily true, maybe.
I'm not so sure that that's... I think it may be true. I'm not so sure that it's limited to folklorists, and I'm certainly not sure that it's limited to, public sector folklorists. I myself am an ethnomusicologist, and I come from a very similar, a related training to folklore, a combination of musicology and anthropology. I think it's probably just true of the all the various social sciences that involve fieldwork of some kind, that most people do most of that kind of work when they are, able to stand it, able to keep up the pace, right? And I know, for example, in universities that scholars there often, do most of their traveling about during their younger years, and then they just draw on that material and write from it for the latter part of their lives. In other words, the fruits of their research might be like 20 years in coming, because it takes them that long to sift through everything and pull through the strands.
It seems easy to develop a sense of urgency about field work. I know you've mentioned to me that often you'll find a subject and get ready to do the research, to go out and get them, and they're gone. They die, or for some reason they're gone. And that's coupled with the idea that traditional arts and crafts and values are dying out. Do you think that's true? Do you think you need to feel that urgency? I don't believe it. Somehow I feel that it's always going to be there.
I've never felt that kind of urgency, although I know that in fields like folklore, anthropology, other fields, that's a concern of people. And from that concern comes, for example, our state mandate, which includes words like preserve the folk culture of, of the state. But really, to me, culture is always evolving and always changing. And the most interesting thing is not necessarily what it used to be, but why it used to be the way it was, why it is the way it is now, and what it might be becoming, 2 seconds from now, tomorrow, whenever. It's very hard to get too upset about something disappearing or songs dying out or whatever, because the reasons why people do certain things in their culture, people do things because they have meaning for them. And when they no longer have a meaning, there's no reason to do them. So the only thing that I ever feel an urgency about, perhaps, is to understand as much as possible about what's going on so that you can understand the future. But not necessarily from the point of view of grab it, keep it.
Right.
The status quo is the way things ought to be, or worse yet, some halcyon era 30 years ago or whatever is the way things really ought to be.
So a word like preserve in the state mandate can't possibly mean preserve in its form to try to somehow force it to stay in that mold,
right,
but to document it and have that to
right
refer to,
mm-hmm,
and to understand what it is now, what it's led to, and that it can't possibly be the way it was.
And also preserve, I suppose, in the sense of preserving people's ability to change their culture. Mm. Not destroying, say, a community arbitrarily for some reason that may not be a very good reason, and thereby preventing those folks from evolving the culture of their own community in a way that's meaningful and useful to them.
And awakening people who might not be aware that what they are doing is not only traditional but valuable, that they would understand that. But in a sense, it's always a fine line, isn't it, between traditional, how do I say this, that people are pursuing traditional occupations rather unself-consciously, but when all of a sudden they're being documented, then they've been removed in a way from their tradition by someone coming in. That's always a delicate business, isn't it?
It's always hard when we're presenting a festival here to take someone out of their community, set them in a space, perhaps in a geographical location that's completely different from their own homes, certainly in a social situation that's different from anything they're used to, and then ask them to just act natural,
be yourself,
carry on do your basket making or show us how you make a boat, just the way you do at home. It's always seemed to me that there's something a little odd about doing that with people, and yet the possible rewards of doing that kind of thing are very great, because for the most part, most members of the public would never get to whatever little town the boatmaker comes from in order to talk to him or ever see a boat being made at all. So they wouldn't know, they would never have a chance to know about this particular craft or the kind of person who is a craftsman of that craft.
I was talking to Mary about the fact that the basket or the boat or the needlework, whatever it is quite incidental, really, isn't it, to the fact that this is a person's work. This is a person's, something of that person's life being demonstrated in a graphic way, a concrete way. But there's more to it than that. It's not just, that's a pretty basket. The process is more important, really, than the product. And it's easy for people to lose track of that, and it's easy to miss that in a festival. But at least you have a clue when you look at a basket that's obviously involved hours of work, and you think, what have I spent hours doing that I have to show something like this?
And what's come from it?
Mm-hmm. People right. See another set of values rather than just a basket or just a boat. There's more, much more than that. And that seems to be the core of what you're really about.
One of the reasons why I came down to work in Florida was that I had determined for myself that one of the things I was most interested in was to help make people more aware of, I guess you might call it, the richness of themselves, and the richness of the people around them who are very ordinary people and who don't on the outside look like they have anything that makes them different from anybody else. I think that's just a very important element in life, and it helps you go beyond the, say, what the news media or the airwaves tell you about people and their lives, because so often what you hear can only be, say, three sentences about something which really should be looked at as a lifetime thing. And you can't go to a person, I guess, and really say to them, okay, tell me what you think, and then have them tell it to you in five sentences and then go away. Because you haven't learned what that person is about. And people who feel that they have learned that, or that all you need to do is read the headlines in the newspapers and you know everything you need to know about Perry, Florida, are just missing something that's very important in life, which is that every single place has its unique qualities, and the people in that place have things to offer the people around them and the people who live nearby that we need to know about and value.
That's one of your greatest challenges, I know, as a professional to be able to just walk cold into a place and expect those people to begin opening up to you for no particular reason except that you're being paid by the state. That's really the only excuse you have. And it takes a long time, doesn't it, to build the trust and the sympathy of those people so that they will feel that you're worth their opening up to you and giving you something of their lives.
It's very hard, for example, to come in and do an interview with somebody because the kinds of questions that you have to ask are very personal questions, and yet there's no reason, as you say, why that person should know you from Adam. Nor should they care. They don't know why you care about what they think. And it's even more intimidating sometimes because, you know, we have to come in with our recording equipment and our microphones and everything. And that's one of the, well, it's one of the techniques of doing field work is that ideally you don't come in with your recording gadgetry first, that you try to make some kind of contact with the person just as another person, and so that you can get to know them at least as an acquaintance, and that person can get to know you, so that then when you do get the person's permission to record them, you're working with an already established good feeling between you.
Of course, you're talking about the luxury of time.
That's right. And it's a luxury that in this kind of position, we don't always have, because time is money. As you know, it's a cliche, but it's absolutely true. And, you know, when you're writing a proposal for a grant to do a certain project, you do as much as you can to assure that you'll have the money that you need to go out in the field and pay for your lodging and your meals and all this stuff. But it always seems to be done in a rush. You always come away feeling, now I just started to get, we really started to get into it. And then the day was over and we had to go home. I suppose that I know, for example, anthropologists who do field work usually try to arrange to spend several months in a place.
Of course, they're going very often in a much more remote area than you are,
right.
Although some of the places you go are fairly remote for your background, for instance, and for most people's background. I think you get in some pretty strange situations.
For example, going to visit the Seminole reservations or... Well, for me, going into the backwoods areas of North Florida and speaking with people that are worlds removed from anything I ever knew growing up, and I'm worlds removed from anything they've ever known growing up.
But don't you feel, I've been surprised and pleased by how people do open up to you. People are trustful of you after not very long a time. I find that you're able to develop a good rapport a lot sooner than I had thought you might. People are ready to help, it seems, quite often.
That I am personally, or that we on
the
staff?
The staff, just the work that I've observed, are anxious quite often to be helpful.
I think that all of us come into this kind of work with the idea that people are interesting. Mm-hmm. And not only people, but persons. I mean, individual people are interesting. And not just from the point of view of, as I say, of an abstract study, but because they are who they are, and what they do has some worth. And I think that if we never really have a course or a training period or workshops in fieldwork techniques in this job, you're supposed to come into it with that already behind you, so that you know what you're doing.
You mean your academic training?
No, I'm talking about this coming into work for the state. The analogy that I'm making in my own mind is that a lot of times a business organization or a commercial firm will have some sort of staff development where people are sent to seminars or workshops to develop certain kinds of skill. Well, in this job, one of the skills that's taken for granted as something that each staff member brings to it already, is the ability to do field work. And, of course, obviously the hiring is done with that in mind. But it's interesting because everyone comes to it from a slightly different training, and yet, but proceeding from the same basic sort of mental set, which is that you, you want to talk to people, you enjoy talking to people, and like to make people feel at ease and learn from them.
It's very taxing work, isn't it?
It's very. It involves your whole body. It involves you physically. It involves you mentally, and it involves you emotionally. And thinking, for example, of the work that we did recently with the Finnish community in Lake Worth, where when we were recording some of these elderly people and doing interviews with them, two of the ladies that I remember began to cry during their interviews because they were talking about things that were very dear to them, separations from their families and how they felt when they were coming to this country for the first time, how lonely it was, how hard it was for them. And after all those years, they still just broke down in tears. That can't help but affect the person who's interviewing as well as, obviously, the interviewee. And often you can come away from a fieldwork situation feeling sort of shaken yourself because you have gone so deep into somebody's life, even in a very short time or on one subject, that it affects you too.
It's easy to say fieldwork as an abstract concept, but when you're out there, it's just people. That's who they are. That's who you're working with. Just one person at a time. And they have their whole lives that you're worming your way into, that you're learning about, sharing.
And for the time that you're with them, those people are the most important people there are right then.
And it's nice to see how honored they are by the fact that you're there quite often. They take that as a very strong compliment. That's a nice relationship I like to see.
That kind of honoring is, I guess, the other side of the coin to the intimidation problem, where people can feel worried or anxious about recording equipment. At the same time, they also feel flattered that you're there at all and that you want to know something that all their friends and family have taken for granted for the last 75 years.
I've heard so many times before. What else should we tell them? Like,
I don't know.
This is good. This is a good one. Let's see. What else should we talk about? We don't want to get into all that festival business. There's no point in that. Oh, I know. I want to hear you tell what brought you to Florida. Could you tell me a little bit about your career, especially where you were living, and then how you ended up in Florida? You know, your time in Indonesia and Germany.
Okay. Well, I told you, my dad is a professor of linguistics. His field is comparative linguistics, and so because of that, he is actually like an anthropologist of the field, within the field of linguistics. He compares language families to each other. Because of his work, we went to Indonesia when I was about 16, and that was the first time I'd ever been away from home, and it was just fascinating to me, even at that age, to live in a culture completely different from mine. And I guess that was the first time I ever did any field work, although I didn't think of it as doing field work. I thought of it as going along with my family to do something interesting that they were doing. And then I put away that experience, I guess, in my mind, and went on to college and majored in music history, graduating and wondering, is this all there is? Because I had been working mainly with Western art music, which is what you learn when you're going through a course in music history. And I kind of took a few years out of my life to decide what further to do, figuring I needed to have somebody pay me while I decided what to do with my life. And then I discovered that there was a field called ethnomusicology, which I guess I had known about that before, but I had never connected it as being related to me in any way. But that discovery was what led me to go to the University of Illinois, where I did graduate work in ethnomusicology. I was going to work at first in Middle Eastern music, but then got so fascinated with American folk music that I just switched into that and have never left it. Where are we on?
Where are we? Okay, let's turn it over. Thank you. This thing is making some noise. Where are we? Okay. So you were at Illinois.
Right. I was at Illinois deciding to continue my work in American folk music. I had joined a group called the American Music Group, which was a group dedicated to performing 19th century American musical styles and other kinds of music relating to musical life in this country. So one of the things that we did was to learn sacred harp singing as within the group to be able to perform it. And our the director of our group, being very foresighted, had all of us go down in small units, like four or five people at a time, from Illinois to northern Alabama, which is where he had grown up, to actually attend a sacred harp sing and get a feel for what the style really was. While I was down for my turn at this sacred harp convention, I was able to talk with some of the elderly people there who had been in that singing tradition for all their lives and got very interested in it. And from them, learned that there were black people who also did this kind of singing, which I hadn't known about before. That discovery led me, was kind of like when I now look back on it, it's almost like being your own detective and finding, just following your nose and finding things of interest along the way.
We have a request. The Xerox machine needs to be...
Okay.
Okay.
You're doing detective work.
Right.
So you had found that there were black singers that you hadn't known about, and it was like doing detective work, and that led you to...
Right. That led me to the work that finally became my dissertation topic, which was black sacred harp singing in southern Alabama. As part of that work, I actually set foot in the state of Florida, in Campbellton, which is the only place in Florida that I know of where black people still sing four-shaped note music. And after I finished my dissertation and was trying to figure out, again at another change point in life, where I wanted to go with my career from then, I began to realize that I didn't want at this time in my life to be in an academic environment anymore. I'd just spent the last 25 years in school of one kind or another. And I realized that what I really wanted to do most was to work somehow to keep doing research and to keep being able to work with ideas and with field work, with gathering information, ethnographic information. But I wanted to find a way of doing it in a situation that would be more sort of public-oriented, that I would be working more immediately with, that I would see results a little more immediately, and that I would be perhaps working in a slightly different organizational setup than is possible in an academic setting. And putting all those things together, and through talking with various people, I discovered that this... I hadn't even known that there was such a thing as applied folklore, coming from a completely different field, and I certainly hadn't known that there was such a thing as a state folklorist. But by talking to people and trying to find out where there might be organizations or groups of people in the world who did the kinds of things I wanted to continue doing, I came I was just told that there were these kinds of people, these kinds of organizations, and found out that this job was available. And one of the main reasons why I was hired was that I had actually, in fact, done some work in Florida before, and I had never thought that that little bit would have been something that would someday be an important reason for doing something that at the time I hadn't known existed. Mm-hmm. So it's been, I've really enjoyed the time that I've been here. And I feel in some ways, I guess, that I, it wasn't by chance that I came down here. But in other ways, I know that it's only been through putting one foot in front of the other and following the path where it led, that I did come here.
Now here you are picking watermelon.
That's right.
And we're back where we're
and a watermelon is brown too. Well, oval anyway.
Oval.
Right.
I think that'll be the trick.
Okay.